Radio. Thank you for joining us. Pleasure to welcome Lawrence Cunningham. He has been writing many books, about a dozen or so, and I believe three of those now, with the new book, deal with Warren Buffett. In 1997, he wrote The Essays of Warren Buffett, Lessons for Corporate America, and he stuck with that theme in the most recent book, Berkshire Beyond Buffett, The Enduring Value of Values by Lawrence A. Cunningham. Larry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
What got you interested in Warren Buffett?
Oh, he's so intriguing. Back in about 20 years ago, I was running a corporate governance program at my school, and I was putting together a list of, you know, exemplars, you know, models of corporate governance, and I stumbled across Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett, as people had said, oh, gee, he's a model, he's a role model, they're an exemplar. And I started to look at it, and just about everything they did was contrary to the received wisdom on corporate governance in terms of boards of directors, the level of independence, consultants, making deals, just one thing after the next. I thought that's a funny kind of role model for a company that's really so contrary. And so I just started looking into more and more of what Berkshire does and what Warren had said, and it just became an endlessly fascinating set of really kind of common sense principles that had not been widely followed in practice. So I started peeling back the onion in corporate governance, and I found them to be fascinating on just about every topic in business and money.
We think of Buffett as buying up diverse companies and then basically letting them just do their own thing. Is that not accurate?
Yeah, that is accurate. I mean, I think I'm glad people are starting to think that way. I mean, Warren's classic, classic definition of Warren is that he's a legendary investor, and certainly Berkshire Hathaway, for many years, served as an investment vehicle for him. So Berkshire, through Warren, 10% of Coca-Cola's stock, 11% of American Express, they had 2% of Procter & Gamble until recently, and so on. But what has really happened in the past 10 years is that those stock investments have become far less important, and Berkshire today is a company. It's a collection of businesses, wholly owned businesses that Berkshire owns and controls outright. And that's what's new and special at Berkshire Hathaway. And that's important because if the company was mostly made up of a bunch of stock picks, picked by a great stock picker, then there wouldn't be much to it.
So, Larry, what is the Berkshire Hathaway moat?
Right. That's a great question. Warren, I think, is pretty famous for telling investors to look for companies that have a moat. And by that, he's referring to the imagery of the medieval castle that has a big ditch around it that protects it from, you know, marauding bandits and invaders. And in the case of a business, he means a competitive advantage that prevents rivals from acquiring market share. And so Berkshire Hathaway, when it looks for investments, whether it's in a stock like Coca-Cola or a wholly owned business like See's Candies, it looks for a company that has a competitive advantage, something that will keep rivals at bay. And so Coca-Cola has it in its trademark and its brand. See's has it in the quality of its candies. And my question in this book was, well, if the investees need to have a moat, what is Berkshire Hathaway's moat? And, you know, a lot of people's instincts might be, well, Warren Buffett, because he's so successful and special and so on. And I thought, well, that really, a person can't be a moat because we're all going to die. So, you know, you can't have a, you know, that's not a durable competitive advantage, because if that person leaves, that disappears. So I looked at that question a little harder, and what I discovered is that Berkshire has a set of businesses united by a set of outlooks, a set of practices that make the company very special. And among those practices are a commitment to the long term, a belief in people, so a trust of managers and employees to make decisions in their zone of responsibility. And I argue, I explain in this book that this set of cultural values is really Berkshire Hathaway's moat. And so it is able to make acquisitions and beat rivals in the acquisition market because sellers of businesses like these kinds of traits. They're attracted to it. So that's what gives Berkshire a tremendous competitive advantage in its, you know, in the primary business it's in, which is acquiring other companies.
It's a bit strange to hear about corporate culture in a conglomerate. And that's that's really what Berkshire is a conglomerate of other companies that have been acquired over the years. How is that possible when you've got, probably more than 100 subsidiaries, and then there are subsidiaries of the subsidiaries, numbering out to probably close to 500?
It's a great question, and that most people wouldn't think a conglomerate could have a discernible culture because of that vastness and that diversity. And you think, you know, companies maybe like General Electric or United Technologies, or certainly, you know, big private equity pools of capital, you know, those things wouldn't likely have a corporate culture. And you might have thought the same thing at Berkshire because of 100 different businesses, as you say. Well, it's funny that when I went in, the way I researched this book, I talked to the CEOs of most of those subsidiaries. I did individual research on each one of the companies and just tried to figure out what made it tick. You know, how does it treat customers? What's the business model? That sort of thing. And then what blew me away, what stunned me in this research, is how each of these subsidiaries, each of these 100 different companies, have the same set of values. The same traits kept coming up over and over again. They're all very thrifty. They all care very much about their reputations in their markets. You know, they believe in the long term. And so just a core set of common values unite all these diverse businesses. And so what that adds up to is, as I explained in the book, is a corporate culture. And the striking thing about that culture, you know, Warren has helped to create it. And what his greatest achievement, though, I think, is putting together a company that is bigger than himself, that, you know, it's got this culture that while, you know, he's a vital part of the company, obviously, he's designed it so that it could prosper even without him at the helm.
How was that culture created? Because if he's just acquiring other companies along the way, how does he create that culture and then infuse it throughout the conglomerate?
Excellent question. The key thing is that these companies tend to have these traits before Berkshire acquires them. Berkshire famously has very few people at its central headquarters in Omaha. It has no managers that it can put into companies it acquires. It doesn't really have any kind of human resources capability to help change an acquired company's culture. So instead, at the outset, a company that Berkshire would have to see these qualities in these companies in order for Berkshire to acquire them. So all of these companies, the 100 plus of them, come with these cultural values, these cultural traits. And then once they're part of Berkshire, all of these traits get reinforced. That is, if a CEO of one of the acquired companies, for example, started to do something inconsistent with these principles, started to jeopardize its reputation for integrity, started to do short-term kinds of thinking, why, he'd be gone. And it doesn't happen often, but I document this in the book, about five or eight times a CEO of an acquired company did something inconsistent with these cultural values, and he was fired. So the companies tend to have these values when they arrive, and then they get reinforced as part of the Berkshire family. It's a remarkable achievement that he's made.
I'm reminded of a line that you had from Buffett, that he looks for integrity, intelligence, and energy, and without that first one, the second two can be killers. And
exactly.
I'm paraphrasing, but
exactly. You know that quality of trustworthiness. It's so important.
How does that figure into the value proposition that we've come to think of when we think of Buffett?
Yeah, it's a key part of it. So the whole culture, I call it a trust-based model of corporate governance. I mean, going back to the first question you asked me about why I was interested in this fellow, this company, is that, you know, most companies have, especially big ones like this, have, you know, a set of commands and controls layers of oversight, reporting, multiple reporting obligations, checks and balances, ways to keep the internal control intact. And Berkshire has pretty much the opposite. It has none of those kinds of things and instead relies on trust. It says, look, you're the CEO or you're the CFO or you're the division president or the vice president. You do what you need to do to achieve these objectives. And so the culture is all about trust. What's amazing about that trust is that if you find trustworthy people, they will actually do better for themselves, for you, for the company than a bureaucracy where there's a lot of checks and balances and a kind of a culture of non-trust. So that's a huge part of Berkshire culture, a huge part of its success. The cost, however, is that sometimes you will make a mistake and you'll trust somebody who doesn't deserve your trust. Someone who, like that quote you just read, is energetic and intelligent but not trustworthy, and they'll make they'll hurt you. The good news at Berkshire is that has not happened very often. It has happened, and that's the cost, but it hasn't happened very often, and the upside has outweighed the downside. But you're absolutely right that the central thing, anybody trying to emulate this model has to be very good at distinguishing between the trustworthy manager and employee and the potential deviant.
And being able to distinguish integrity in corporations is not an easy trait, something that clearly Buffett is pretty good at. And that brings us back to the idea of Berkshire beyond Buffett. After he goes, how is it possible to maintain that discretion towards integrity?
Right. I mean, that is the billion-dollar question, or maybe the trillion-dollar question, if you like. And my thought on that is that what's most striking about Berkshire is that he has managed to make it something other than a one-man show. He's managed to institutionalize these traits, and that is partly by selecting senior managers, the people who run each of these subsidiaries, tend to have the kinds of traits that Warren himself has and that he has, looked for in people. So they may not, I don't think anyone's going to be as good at him at investing or sizing people up or sizing businesses up, but these men and women tend to have the kind of traits that will facilitate that kind of wisdom. And so, they have each hired their own number twos, and those guys in turn have hired people. When you look across the management teams at these subsidiaries, you get these guys are all pretty good. They believe in a trust-based model of corporate governance, and so, they've developed the skill of figuring out who can I trust with this, huge acquisition or this huge pot of money. And so they've developed these skills at that level too. And that's the striking thing about all these traits over and over again that I see at the companies, is that there are a lot of people who have followed, the model, or at least I'm not even sure if they did it sort of consciously, but they have embraced the same kinds of values that Buffett himself has stood for. Even long before they became part of the Berkshire family. So I'm not saying it's perfect, and there's certainly no guarantee that the people who succeed Warren will be as successful. But what I do claim is that the culture is an important part of the prospects for Berkshire's prosperity after Warren.
Well, that brings us round to perhaps the next big question, and we'll get to that in just a moment as we continue our conversation. The question is, of course, what happens if Buffett is hit by a truck? We'll talk about that as we continue our conversation with Lawrence Cunningham. The new book, Berkshire Beyond Buffett, The Enduring Value of Values, by Lawrence Cunningham. Berkshire Beyond Buffett. And we'll have more of this conversation in just a moment. Money Radio, thank you so much for joining us. We're talking with Lawrence Cunningham, the new book, Berkshire Beyond Buffett. And, of course, we're talking about Berkshire Hathaway and Warren Buffett. And Warren Buffett is now about 84 years old. He's still in good health. He looks as active as ever, as sharp as ever. But what happens if Warren Buffett is hit by a truck?
Excellent question. And we have been asking that for 20 years. And, you know, some of us joke that the stock price of the Class A is over $200,000 today, and we joke that it will hit $1 million a share when he turns 100. The board of directors and Warren have put into place a succession plan that has three parts. And so his job will be split into three. There'll be a CEO in charge of acquisitions and capital allocation, a CIO in charge of the portfolio of investments, and a chairman of the board who's going to sort of make sure that no one forgets the cultural traits that I'm talking about. So his own job will be split three ways, and that's really important because Warren's been there every step of the way for 50 years, so he knows things that no one else can possibly know. So that's the sort of the personnel aspect. The second thing is the shareholdings, that he's been the controlling shareholder for 50 years and been gradually reducing his ownership so that now he's got 34% of the economic stake and 20% of the vote. And his estate calls for transferring those shares gradually over a period of about 10 years to foundations, including the Gates Foundation. So you'll gradually shift from having Warren as a controlling shareholder to having the marketplace own all his shares. There'll never be a time when there's some other controlling shareholder. It'll always be his estate with that gradually distributed and liquidated out through the foundations. So that's the formal plan. And the other thing that's part of it, and this is the point of my book, is that another important part of the succession plan is this corporate culture that's been created, that these companies and the people who founded them and run them have a set of core common values that is going to be very hard to disturb. And those core common values are all about keeping the company together, on track, forever, run by, trustworthy people. So it's a pretty elaborate succession plan. If you got hit by a truck, there'd be a lot of, uncertainty in the market, in the stock market and so on. But in terms of the operations of the company and its prospects, it should stay as on course as, it's possible to make a company stay on course.
As we look at the biggest threats to a successful succession, one of the things that you mentioned in the book is short-termitis, which is an affliction that has hit much of corporate America. Is that the major concern for a successful succession at Berkshire?
Yeah, I do think so. I mean, because the company is built on this sense of permanence. It's never sold a subsidiary in 40 years. It's bought 60 of them plus indirect ownership, and it has never sold one. The common stock positions can be sold. They have been sold, but they've never sold a subsidiary. So this is a commitment to stay with the businesses acquired through thick and thin and to give the managers of those businesses total autonomy in running them. And I think the biggest concern in the 6 months or year after Warren leaves the scene is that activist shareholders will pressure Berkshire Hathaway to sell some of those subsidiaries that aren't performing so well, or agitate for serious business and strategic change, telling the presidents of those companies what to do. So you'll have this enormous pressure from activist shareholders who might acquire 3 or 4%, and put pressure on whoever the CEO is, whoever the CIO is, the chairman of the board, and they'll have to respond. Now, if they capitulate, if they were to say, okay, there's these 3 or 4 or 5 non-performing subsidiaries, and there are some businesses within Berkshire that are not performing as well, and they hold them for the long term anyway and try to help them through it. But if the activist shareholders put enough pressure on the incumbent managers and the incumbent managers were to decide, okay, we're going to sell, that would, I think, destroy what is special about Berkshire Hathaway.
Lawrence Cunningham, the new book, Berkshire Beyond Buffett. It's an amazing story, unique in America. And Lawrence Cunningham has been following this story for many years, writing extensively about it, probably has about as much knowledge and research on this topic as anyone. The new book, Berkshire Beyond Buffett. You will find it very interesting, well-written as well. Lawrence Cunningham, Berkshire Beyond Buffett, thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.